This is the fifth day of this November 2011 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of the Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim from the book called The Way of Korean Zen. We're reading from a 90-day winter retreat. This is one of his talks. Being bound by circumstances originates from the mind's own bondage. Likewise, liberation from the suffering of birth and death ensues from the mind's being liberated from them. This is the Dharma of one mind. Everything there is proceeds from this one mind. Access to the doors of both liberation and bondage lies in your own hands. It is not dependent upon anyone else. It is not dependent upon the Buddhas, nor the patriarchs, nor the spiritual advisors, teachers. It is solely in your own hands. We read similar passage yesterday and talked about what power we have through the mind to overcome painful circumstances. At the risk of getting too personal, this little story about when my mother was dying. Those last few weeks, she was suffering from. She had had two intestinal surgeries, and the first one didn't go well, and the second one left her in a lot of damage. And as she was lying there, she wasn't eating or drinking anything. She was, of course, bedridden, and knew she was dying. And there were a couple of times when she had an open wound that had to be attended to and all, and there were a couple of times when my sisters told me that they leaned in to her and said, how are you, Mom? And she just murmured, her eyes are closed on her back, and she said, it couldn't be any better. As someone who never did meditation, but especially someone who hadn't even trained her mind in that way, to be able to reach that kind of serenity and peace in spite of these very considerable wounds that she was suffering from. It was quite confirming. Of course, we get practice at this in Sesshin. With our pain, our physical pain. Pain is so much affected by the mind, by our attitude, by the degree to which we are separating ourselves from the pain with thoughts about it or not. It's not a black and white thing. It's short of extraordinary circumstances, if we have pain, there's a physical component to the experience of the pain, but much of that can be overcome by the mind. What it takes is a total commitment to the practice. You have to get into a samadhi, and in doing so, then we have the ability to fully transcend the pain. This doesn't mean we get rid of it entirely. It's just that our relationship to the pain changes. It's there, but it's not the same. It's not this oppressive experience. It's more in the background. And then he gives a verse, all the mountains, all the rivers, such a beautiful landscape. During endless eons in each life, this world has appeared. No amount of praise could be enough. It is not the product of anyone's strength. Every single aspect of it arises from your own mind. And then he comments, last autumn the maple trees were a brilliant red, the chrysanthemums fragrant, the mountains and rivers a magnificent sight. When we see all these beautiful things, we all know how to be happy. During endless eons in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. When the moon is bright and the wind blows, some say that the moon is shining brightly and a refreshing wind is blowing. However, others say that the moon looks bleak and the wind is dreary. In reality, do you think that the moon is shining brightly to some and bleakly to others? This is not the case. These are circumstantial impressions arising from their own minds. Again, from Affirming Faith in Mind, things are things because of mind. And then he just concludes, in brief, to awaken to the mind should be your fundamental goal. Third, talk. Since the subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment has been present even before the creation of the earth, it has never been lost. Why do you say that you are looking for it again? From long ago until now, it has been unimpeded and has been shining brightly and tranquilly. Assembly gathered here today, have you completely awakened to it or not? If there is a monk endowed with the Dharma eye, let him say something. In reality, what is this subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment? Huck! This nature of ours, this luminous nature of ours, has been unimpeded and shining brightly and tranquilly from long ago until now. We couldn't shake this light if we tried. It's all within us, around us. No one is without this light. He goes on, let me introduce you to a few words from a lecture of Master Zong Jing. I don't know if that would be an earlier Chinese master or a Korean master. He once said, all sentient beings are covered by the six dusts. And then Kusan says, this means that they are covered by the six kinds of thieves that come from the outside. He discusses these six kinds of thieves. This is a very well-known metaphor that in the Buddhist texts. So I'm going to read more about these six kinds of thieves. If you feel that you are not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world pass through the six sense doors, are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. By the way, the six, we know the five, the standard five senses, and then the sixth is considered in Buddhism, the sixth sense is the mind, the thinking mind. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. And as soon as you are deceived in even the slightest way by one of these thieves, it is equivalent to being killed by them. For at that moment, they take control of your mind. Because of them, intrinsic Buddhas are made to act like ordinary sentient beings. So, before we go on with the six thieves, there's always the danger in what we hear, what we see, what we feel, what we smell, what we taste, and what thoughts come through the mind. There's always the danger that we that these direct experiences of hearing and seeing and smelling and so forth, that they get mediated by thoughts. That's the real problem. The sounds and the smells and the sights and the tastes and so forth, even the thoughts, needn't be a problem. It's when we get caught in them, when we become attached to thoughts about them. Even thoughts themselves. Thoughts are always streaming through the mind in some very innocent way. This is the sort of a baseline activity of the brain. This is what the brain does. It generates some slight thought activity, just as our glands secrete things without our volition. This kind of innocent, continuous little thought activity is like a secretion of the brain. And if we don't pursue these little thoughts that flicker through the mind, then they will be no problem. It's just like one of the other five senses. He explains it here. In the face of these six thieves because they steal from us this bright, clear purity of our original nature. In the face of these six thieves, you need the courage of a soldier on the front line fighting the enemy. When suddenly faced with an enemy in the midst of a battle, a soldier does not have the time to ponder whether his adversary can shoot well or not, or whether such a shot would be fatal. In order not to risk being killed by the enemy's fire, he is simply forced to shoot immediately. Well, not forced. Similarly, as soon as the slightest thought appears in the doorway of one of the six senses, you should be as alarmed as though a thief were trying to break into your house. The moment one of the six thieves shows itself in the doorway of the senses, the koan investigation of the essential will have deserted you. Otherwise, how could one of the thieves have appeared in the first place? For as long as the koan is held firmly in mind, the six sense doors will be kept tightly closed, and there will be no gap through which a thief could enter. Again, the thief being the thought that sticks to the pure experience, the sense experience. Therefore, while the koan remains vivid, you remain alive. But as soon as one of the six thieves manages to enter the door of the senses, you are already dead. This metaphor, I hope it's not too much of a strain for people to appreciate. I think people who have been in a deep state of concentration and seen and experience for themselves how thoughts tend to insinuate themselves in the mind, and how when they do, when the thought does get in the way, it's a loss. It's a fall. It sullies the pure, immediate experience of hearing or seeing and so forth. The Japanese word for this is nen. It's extremely difficult to translate, but you talk about successive nen. The first nen, according to this system, and this is straight standard Buddhist teaching. The first nen is the direct experience, just the sound. The second nen is the accretion, the what is added to it, a thought about it. It's not just the, but it's then a millionth of a second later, some little association or memory or judgment or other kind of thought. This all takes place in blinding speed. And then that can lead to the third nen, which is once more removed from the original pure experience of hearing, and then so forth. And then this is what in English what we call a train of thought. Then we're off. So the trick is to have the mind so alert, so present, that it doesn't divert into that second nen, that additional thought. The great Chinese master Linchi or Rinzai said, "Learn to cut off successive nen, and this is worth more than 10 years of pilgrimage." This is the work we're doing. Many of you may not have structured it this way in your mind. You may not have articulated it this way in your mind, but this is what you're doing. Learning to not take any of those exits from the throughway that get us off somewhere else. He goes on, "In order to cause the downfall of the six thieves, you must cast aside all concern for the body. You should discard it as you would a useless stone that serves no purpose. Habitually, you blindly follow your uncontrolled attachment to the body and thus spend your entire lives trying to feed it and clothe it well, thereby making sure that it is comfortable. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been the servant of the body, and thus have played the role of an ordinary sentient being. But from now on, you should learn to make it serve you. Likewise, instead of being captivated by the six senses, you should also make them obey you. Henceforth, it is you who must have the final word. In this way, your practice will be able to progress well." One last paragraph. "It is a great mistake to think that after having practiced hard for a few days, you are then entitled to lie back and enjoy yourself for a while. It is easy to find any number of pretexts for behaving in this manner, but to do so will cause you to be killed by the six thieves. Thus, you will be reduced to playing the role of a corpse." And then back to where we were a little while ago, he refers to this mind as the treasure. This treasure will always stay just as it is. Moreover, even though a diamond is extracted from very deep within the earth, it cannot be destroyed. You should bear this in mind. The wisdom of your original nature is always clear and bright. It never changes. This year, a good assembly of monks has gathered here in the monastery and is indeed making sincere efforts to practice meditation. Assembly, within this year, you must really break through the skin of ignorance. But this is not done easily and quickly. You must first give rise to the greatest possible faith and determination. You must be prepared to die. Often you practice just because others are doing so, with no urgency at all. You think that it is as easy as cooling hot porridge by simply pouring a little cold water over it. Your meditation will never progress if you practice in such a way. When he says prepared to die, this doesn't need to be taken as physical death. Prepared to die means to give up everything, every thought, every mental attachment, to give it up. We do that through complete absorption in the practice. We don't even have to. Strictly speaking, we don't have to think about giving it up, letting it go, or anything like that. The practice does it for us. The koan or the breath does it for us. We just have to completely fuse with the practice, the breath or the koan, and these impediments will perish. They will vanish. There's no doing anything with them that's required of us. Then that would be more complicated if we had to do two things: become one with the practice and on the side try to get rid of these thoughts. That would be complicated. It's much more simple than that. Just become one with the practice, and the thoughts will disappear. Now the fourth talk. Today is the last day of the lunar month. The new moon is so bright that its light pervades the entire Dharma Dhatu. Notice there, the new moon. New moon is a moon that, in conventional terms, emits no light. The new moon is so bright that its light pervades the entire Dharma Dhatu. Long ago, Master Nanshuan, that's Zhao Zhou's teacher, Joshu's teacher, Master Nanshuan once took his assembly of monks to look at the moon. So is this moon I am talking of the same as or different from the moon that Master Nanshuan gazed at? Of course, he's not just talking about the moon. Assembly of monks, it's true that these days you are exerting much effort in your practice. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed, for today we have reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left. Every day, time flows on urgently like water. even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in daily life, actually, we are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. When all the water is gone, the fish will surely die, won't they? Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by one day, and as each hour passes, it decreases by one hour. Then he refers to a clock that must be right there at hand. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a Dharma talk of the Buddha. The demon of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. If you do not realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or would it be better to live in order to awaken to the truth of the unborn? When you are finally moaning in illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive. But at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around? These are the words of one who has really come to terms with the ephemeral nature of life, the transitoriness. It seems that most of us only really grasp this as we get on in age. Fortunate are those young people who really see this truth, things as they are, that we are like fish in a pool that is being constantly drained away. Some of these teachings by Kusan Sini may strike people as being hard and rough and grim, but behind these warnings is the deepest concern for his students. He knows that without making every effort while we can, regrets can follow. Disappointments later in life. Sense of missed opportunity. This is his compassion speaking. It's not just trying to whip his monks into a greater exertion for the sake of exertion. He wants to see them spared unnecessary suffering. Goes on. Keep your koan bright and do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the koan should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. In some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they will put some fragrant oil in the pointed end of a horn and place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted by the smell, and once it thinks that it's safe, crawls into the horn. It gets nearer and nearer the oil until finally its body gets stuck in the pointed end and it is unable to withdraw. In order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? You should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. This phrase, all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. I remember hearing this similar phrase when Roshi Kaplow was reading in Taisho and Sesshin, and having spent a number of Sesshins struggling to get beyond these delusive thoughts, it started to seem like an impossible task. When could that ever happen? But the truth is, it can happen in no time. Suddenly, there are no thoughts. It's not, don't visualize some escalator up into the clouds that you have to take years and years and years to finally get to this place where there are no thoughts. It can happen in an instant if you're working sincerely, earnestly, with your whole mind. You can suddenly find yourself free of thoughts. And we never know when this might happen. He goes on, throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, the mass of questioning is clear and awakening is very close by. It is as though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. Soon the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death through achieving liberation from them. In order to avenge yourself of such an enemy who has tormented you for so long, shouldn't you exert yourself to the utmost? You must be determined to pass over this crucial step. Otherwise, if you let it go by, the koan will gradually lose its vividness and it will be even harder to reach such a state again. Therefore, do not waste this opportunity. Roshi Kaplow used to say at this point of Sesshin, to reach this level of absorption in the practice, again, would take another 5 days of Sesshin. because we do fall back after Sesshin. When we're not sitting around the clock after Sesshin, thoughts gradually take back the lost ground from Sesshin, and we find it much harder. It's not impossible. People have come to awakening outside Sesshin, but it's harder. This is the chance. Still plenty of time left in Sesshin to do this. Goes on, when deluded people look inside themselves, they will find there are things to be cultivated and to be gained. Therefore, they make a great effort to practice. But as soon as they have completed what they set out to do, they realize that there was nothing really to have been done. Thus, the true Dharma involves non-doing. All things that are done will finally cease. Thus, the Dharma of doing is the false Dharma. Let me just pause and clarify this. We have to get to the point where we allow the koan, the breath, the practice, to come into its own and to do itself. In the end, it's not something that any of us can do, really. It's not that I or anyone else can do this practice. It's done through us. It's done through our efforts. But there's no I to do it. And this is a crucial turning point when we realize that we can, by just getting out of the way, which means stop thinking, by getting out of the way, that this practice will do itself. It takes on a life of its own. It's bigger, far bigger than any one of us. This mind, this yearning to know itself. There's a phrase, I think it's from Taoism, but it might as well be Buddhism, doing nothing, yet leaving nothing undone. The practice, our individual practice that we're working on, is a method through which we can just get out of the way and let things run their natural course, the ultimate unfolding of this true self. The more thoroughly we're absorbed in our practice, the more this mind, this miraculous, luminous mind, has a way to come to realization. Again, thus the Dharma of doing is the false Dharma. But everything that you do, which in reality is non-doing, constitutes eternal truth. Such actions will not cease even though you attempt to be finished with them. This is the truth of the unborn and undestroyed. Therefore, all the Buddhas of the three times, that's past, present, and future, all the patriarchs, the bodhisattvas, the teachers of the present age, have expounded and are expounding the Dharma that is no Dharma. If someone claims that something was said, this would be mistaken. in this world, all people look for the Dharma of doing, that is, for something. But the true Dharma is to look for the Dharma of non-doing. This is truly extraordinary. Throughout beginningless eons, the way has been obscured by the great weight and depth of defilements. Exactly how heavy and deep are those defilements? They are as heavy as the earth and as deep as the ocean. Defilements are actually the habitual tendencies you have acquired since beginningless time. They are so deeply ingrained within you and weigh you down so greatly. How can you not see the need to practice with the utmost diligence? Of course, the primary habitual tendency that afflicts us is our habit of grasping at our thoughts, clinging to our thoughts. The defilements are like clouds covering the sun. Although the sun shines brightly behind the clouds, its brightness cannot be seen. Only when the clouds disperse will its brilliance be clearly apparent. Now, if you really want to unearth a precious gem from the mud and stones of defilements, you should think of how snow and ice harden and melt. Recently, there has been much snow here. Now it has packed and hardened on the ground and will not melt very quickly. Just look. The snow is delivering an unsurpassable discourse on Dharma. For to dissolve the defilements and discover your true nature is similar to the melting of this snow. In order for it to melt, it must be exposed to the sun. Thereupon it turns into water, which you can then use for drinking, washing, and so forth. Imagine how long it would take to melt if it were only exposed to the sun for one day and then allowed to harden again over the following 10 cold days. It is similar when you try to practice meditation. If you practice hard for one day but then relax and enjoy yourselves during the next 10 days, how will the hardened crust of the defilements ever melt? Even in the midst of the utmost quiescence, you should never let the koan fade. For if at such times it remains bright and vivid, then great awakening will draw nearer. Furthermore, the meditator should now consider the koan as his very life. When coming, the koan should be coming. When going, the koan should be going. While eating, the koan should be eating. And even while defecating, it should be the koan that defecates. If you practice in such a way, then great awakening will certainly be closer. Therefore, do not just idly enjoy yourselves to no purpose. Well, we know that no one is here and Sasheen is idly enjoying herself or himself, at least not for any length of time. I don't really have the opportunity. Here, this is a 90-day retreat. The tendency would be, of course, to have it more relaxed, more opportunity to idly enjoy oneself and goof off. But that's the strength of a shorter retreat, actually, is we don't have the time to maneuver and become lax. The schedule itself almost prevents that. We have to just keep at it. And this is part of the strength of the structure. well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.